This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Season 2 of NHPR's newest show, Outside In, premieres this weekend, in addition to its ongoing podcasts, and among its latest topics, the back and forth over biocontrol. It's an approach scientists have used for a long time, introducing non-native species, whether beetles or bugs or fungus, to combat harmful invasive pests and plants. Biocontrol has had some huge successes over the years. For example, rescuing the cassava crop in Africa, a food that hundreds of millions of people rely on. But there have been some legendary failures, too, where the introduced plant or creature that was supposed to help ended up causing damage instead. Today in The Exchange, biocontrol, how it works, and whether it's a good idea. What do you think? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also find us at NHPR Exchange on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Our guests are Sam Evans-Brown, as I said, host of NHPR's newest show. And Sam, thank you so much and congratulations.
Thanks for having me on.
Also joining us from California, Mark Hoddle, specialist in biological control in the Department of Entomology at the University of California at Riverside. And Mark Hoddle, good morning. Thank you for being with us as well.
Good morning, and thank you very much for inviting me to participate in this.
And also with us from Tennessee is Dan Simberloff. He's a professor in the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville. He's editor of the Encyclopedia of Biological Invasions. And Professor Simberloff, good to have you too. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, Sam, biocontrol has been described in so many colorful ways, playing with God, messing with Mother Nature, but also fighting fire with fire. What's your best description of this to somebody who's never heard of it?
Yeah, so it's this whole process through which scientists, you know, usually botanists or biologists, go out and take on these sort of Indiana Jones-esque excursions where they go back to the native range of a new pest that has spread into a new region. They go back to where it came from and they study its life history and they see what is it that's killing it back in its home range. So finding pathogens that are killing it when it's young, or finding predators that are eating it at various stages in its life cycle, and they then ask, you know, can we bring those to follow it? You know, can we make it so that its predators catch up with it to the new space that it spread to, and can we safely introduce it to as a way to bring this invasion under control?
Safely being the magic word. So, for example, Sam, if something came here from Europe and started munching on, you know, American trees or plants or whatever, we would say, all right, what is the main predator for that insect in Europe? Let's bring it over and see if it can help us get rid of it.
Right. And here in New England, the sort of poster child for a European invasion was the gypsy moth, which for nearly a century was, as you just said, munching on trees here in New England. And was in the 80s more or less brought under control by a suite of pathogens, viruses, bacteria, viruses and fungi that were brought from its native range and more or less got that invasion under control.
Well, and just remind us, Sam, how bad that invasion was. I mean, the trees really took it on the chops here in New England.
Yeah, and we had an outbreak this summer that if you were in sort of eastern Massachusetts or by the Atlantic coast, there was huge amounts of defoliation this summer, but it did not rival the worst outbreak back in the 80s when, you know, it was you know, hundreds of millions of acres defoliated by gypsy moth caterpillars, and concern that there were going to be massive die-offs of trees here in the Northeast if we didn't get it dealt with.
Well, in your latest episode that, again, is premiering this weekend, you've got some researchers who worked very hard to fight the gypsy moth, you know, just a terrible battle. And here they are reacting to finally seeing this fungus that worked as a biocontrol. And they just sound really thrilled. It was a big turnaround. Let's hear.
Oh, it was very exciting indeed. And yeah, that there are just dead gypsy moths, caterpillars all over the tree trunks.
They basically appeared overnight. We walked out into our research plots out at the Quabbin Reservoir. There were dead caterpillars hanging everywhere.
And again, we heard from Ann Hayek of Cornell and Joe Elkington of the University of Massachusetts. So, Professor Cymbaloff, I want to turn to you. There's a happy story about biocontrol, but it doesn't always end that well. What's the dark side of biocontrol?
Non-target impacts, and I guess there are two. One is non-target impacts. That is, the introduced species affect some species that's a native species that wasn't the target of the project. And the second is it sometimes doesn't work. It often doesn't work. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't.
So in a best-case scenario, it doesn't work. Okay, we tried, but it didn't work. In a worst case, you said non-target impact. So give us a little bit more on that, Professor Cymbaloff.
Well, a very good example is the introduction of a beetle to attack musk thistle, which is one of the greatest plant pests in the United States. And it does, but it also attacks many native thistles, including one species on the U.S. endangered species list and two candidate species. And the fact that it attacks musk thistle exacerbates the problem because it keeps the population of the beetle high, and therefore it's always present to attack these native thistle species.
How often, Professor Cymbaloff, do you think biocontrol goes awry?
It's hard to say. I think it went awry probably pretty frequently for plants until maybe 20 or 25 years ago, and I think it's not likely to go awry for plants very often now. For insects, it's really hard to say because we don't do nearly sufficient research to determine what the real impact is on non-target species. And it's tricky because just seeing a biocontrol predator or a parasitoid wasp or fly attacking a native species doesn't mean it's really having an impact. We'd have to demonstrate there's a population effect. So the research would be substantial, and it's just not being done in almost any case.
Well, and Mark Hoddle, I want to bring you into this too. The concern that, you know, biocontrol sometimes works and sometimes it doesn't, and if it doesn't, you've got a real problem on your hands. What do you think, Mark Hoddle?
Right, so Dan brings up a couple of interesting points, and with the thistle weevils, you know, he's right that the introduced agent does attack a native thistle. But that was clearly demonstrated when the host specificity testing work was done for those weevils back in the 1960s. And the prevailing public opinion at that time and the regulatory agents pretty much was any thistle was a bad thistle. And these introduced thistles are an extremely important problem that needs to be dealt with. And the decision was made to go ahead and release those weevils anyway. So there's been a retroactive an analysis looking back on those decisions, and in hindsight, all of us agree it probably wasn't a good idea, and those types of releases wouldn't be made anymore. Dan also indicated that plant biocontrol has gone awry a lot of times, and it's only really improved in the last 25 years or so. That statement's not completely accurate either. Weed biological control probably has the best track record and the highest rates of success of the biocontrol programs that have been run. When you get to insects, Dan's right about not enough follow-up work going on with what the impacts of those released natural enemies are that are attacking insect pests. But there have been quite a few follow-up studies looking at the impact some of those introduced agents have had on native insects, and there have been documented attacks. And in some instances, those attacks have been quite severe, and Joe Elkington talked about that with the beautiful satin-eared moths in the northeastern United States that came about from some of the gypsy moth control agents, especially at the Kinnard fly, Consulera concinnata. But there have been many more studies looking for similar effects that have failed to find such impacts, even though they were predicted by ecologists as having happened. And apparently, from the field work that's been done, especially in places like Hawaii, which seems to be very sensitive to invasive species, those types of negative impacts on population, causing population declines of native moths at any rate, haven't been documented.
Yeah, islands in particular come up a lot in this episode of Outside In on biocontrol. Sam Evans-Brown, I wanted to get you in on this too, the narrative about biocontrol and how, you know, it can go awry. There's a lot of fear around that. But before we do, you had a little clip in your show. This actually came up on The Simpsons when Bolivian tree lizards are accidentally introduced into the town of Springfield. Residents are upset at first, then some are delighted when it turns out the lizards love pigeon meat. I'm going to play this because it really does show an example of people's fears that this could get out of control.
Well, I was wrong. The lizards are a godsend.
But isn't that a bit short-sighted? What happens when we're overrun by lizards?
No problem. We simply unleash wave after wave of Chinese needle snakes. They'll wipe out the lizards.
But aren't the snakes even worse?
Yes, but we're prepared for that. We've lined up a fabulous type of gorilla that thrives on snake meat.
But then we're stuck with gorillas.
No, that's the beautiful part. When wintertime rolls around, the gorillas simply freeze to death.
That's an episode of The Simpsons talking about biocontrol. That's what we're talking about today in The Exchange. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, 1-800-892-6477. So, Sam, there's the narrative. People frustrated with this idea.
Yeah, so I think what we can really quickly get lost in sort of scientific names of all the species impacted by various biocontrol efforts. But I think what you really see when you look at how biocontrol has been interpreted throughout the years is that early on there wasn't a lot of value placed in native species. So even though we might have known that we were going to kill some native caterpillars by introducing a fly that would attack gypsy moths, people didn't care because they thought, you know, native caterpillars also eat crops and you know that impacts our agriculture. So that's fine. Let's get rid of all the caterpillars. And so what you've really seen is that as values have shifted in sort of 60s, 70s, 80s, when the environmental movement really kicked off, so too did our feeling about biocontrol shift. And so, you know, we heard the example of the thistle weevils and that were introduced out in the West. They knew that these weevils were going to attack native thistles, but people didn't care about native thistles, and so they went forward anyway. So I think that what you saw with biocontrol is, you know, The first really critical essay written about it came out in the 80s. A man named Frank Hoarth wrote this thing called Biocontrol, Panacea or Pandora's Box, and it really captured the mood of the time, which was that with all of the advances that our society has brought us, there have been these unintended consequences. So, you know, the Clean Air and Clean Water Act, unintended consequences of industrialization were getting cleaned up. There was Silent Spring, Rachel Carson writing about unintended consequences of getting chemicals into our daily life. And so that really fit the narrative of that moment, and it was really seized upon. And I think that's in part why you don't really hear much of the contrasting narrative, which is that this is a tool that sometimes can be used safely. And instead of hearing about the many, many success stories, we mostly hear about the failures.
So is that part of the problem with this narrative, Sam, that early on when people were using biocontrol, they didn't really care about unintended consequences, wiping out native species and so forth? So it's not really fair to look at it with a modern lens and say that didn't work. People initially didn't care if it hurt other species.
Yeah, it worked exactly as they hoped it would, which is included wiping out native species. That was the value of the time. And not only that, but there were some instances of early biocontrol that were being carried out, you know, especially introduction of cane toads in various islands all across, you know, the Pacific and the Caribbean. Cane toads were introduced frequently by farmers. This was not something that was being done by scientists. So it was a very different process back in the day.
It wasn't a controlled experiment.
Exactly.
What do you think, Dan Simberloff?
Well, first I have to correct an error of fact that in what Mark said and what Sam has repeated. Actually, the Canadian scientist who introduced the beetle to control musk thistle did not intend, they did not realize it would have a major impact on native thistles. In fact, they specifically tested but they didn't test correctly, and they determined that it would not have a major impact on native thistles, and that's when they released it. Their problem was that they only tested it against four native North American thistles when there are over 90 species.
So they weren't careful enough.
They weren't careful, and secondly, they didn't do the right kinds of tests. They did the tests where the beetles had a choice, and they usually went to musk thistle, but that isn't really adequate to show what will happen in the field when there's very little musk thistle.
So what do you think?
They did not say that it would not have that it would have an effect on the native thistles, and that's all right. They specifically said it would not have an impact on native thistles.
Professor Cymbeloff, more broadly, what do you think about the idea that Sam presents that it's not really fair to judge some of these experiments in the distant past, given that the value of native species in the past was not what we have today? What do you think about that?
Well, it's a mixed bag. The introduction of the cane toad to control an insect that was attacking sugar cane, one could easily understand the motives, and it wasn't, as Sam said, they did virtually no testing other than that it would actually eat the insect in a laboratory. Other times, it's sort of shocking. Introduction of the mongoose to islands all over the world and even to mainland in some cases to control rats and sugar cane when, it was very obvious that mongooses would eat almost anything else, including ground nesting birds. So even though it was done at a time when native species were not of tremendous concern, some people did worry about it then, and they went ahead and did it anyway. So I wouldn't be as categorical as he is, but certainly I agree that in general we have to consider what people were thinking about at that time.
Sure. And Mark Hoddle, what do you think is part of the problem with this narrative that we heard, so perfectly summed up in that Simpsons clip? Is part of the problem that people in the past especially were just kind of sloppy about this?
I agree with what Dan has said that, in the past and with Sam's commentary that in the past there have been some egregious historical errors. The mongoose is one example, and I'm from New Zealand and I've seen the damage that, ferrets, stoats and weasels have done to New Zealand's native birds, and it's very sad. And it does generate this idea with the public that once these biocontrol agents, like these vertebrate predators get out of control and cause damage, then, maybe we should be thinking about releasing additional agents to control them. But to the best of my knowledge, that type of cascade of releases, of introducing more and more natural enemies of the natural enemies, has never been done. But it is a perception that that's something scientists have the ability to do, but I'm unaware of it having been executed.
What do you think, Sam? The perception. That seems to be the big problem here.
Well, what I can tell you is that, for instance, here in New Hampshire, that we have the emerald ash borer, which is one of the many invasive species that is attacking our trees here in New Hampshire. There have been a couple of wasps that have been introduced to go after the emerald ash borer. And whenever I tell the story to just friends, random people in my life that, this is something that's happening here in New Hampshire, the reaction is almost universally. I mean, people of sort of every political leaning will say, oh, that seems like a bad idea. And so I do think that that is the dominant narrative in our culture today.
We'll talk more after a short break, including what invasive species are problematic here in New England and some of the biocontrols being used or thought about against them. Let's hear from you, too. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Keep it right here. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the back and forth over biocontrols. As NHPR's newest show, Outside In, opens its second season this weekend, host Sam Evans-Brown looks at this debate, the arguments around using certain bugs or plants to combat invasive species. Let's get your questions, comments, and thoughts in. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. What damage have you seen from invasive species around you? What measures would you like to be taken against those invasive species? Again, 1-800-892-6477. Send email to exchange@nhpr.org. And if you prefer Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, we're at NHPR Exchange. Sam Evans-Brown is with me in studio. Joining us from California is Dan Simberloff, professor in the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Tennessee. Also, Mark Hoddle, he's a specialist in biological control at the Department of Entomology at the University of California at Riverside. One more time, that exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. And Sam, just before the break, you were starting to talk about some specific examples here in New England. And I'd love to get a little bit more from you, please, and from our other guests on what's been especially problematic in our part of the country.
So there are plenty of invasives that have been a problem. I mentioned emerald ash borer. That's the one that's sort of most recent concern. In the Midwest, there were where it was first introduced over in Michigan, there were documented to be upwards of 90% mortality of ash trees there caused by this beetle.
90%.
Yeah.
A lot.
So basically, we're talking about. I mean, if we look back in history, we can talk about the chestnut tree, which was one of the most common trees in the forests on the east coast of the United States, and it was totally wiped out by an invasive Chinese blight. And a lot of people think that that's what we're going to see with the ash tree as well, that essentially a tree that was once one of the most common trees in the forest will cease to exist in the Northeast if the beetle, runs its full course as is expected to do. There are lots of other invasive species that many of which have been introduced by us intentionally. I mean, you can look, Oriental bittersweet is one that you'll see as you drive up and down the highways here in New Hampshire, was introduced as a way to feed the turkeys that were being reintroduced to New Hampshire. So we wiped out the turkeys through hunting. We reintroduced the turkeys because we like to have them around. And in order for them to have something to eat in the winter, a lot of plants that have berries in the winter were planted, including bittersweet, which is now out of control.
And what does that look like?
Oh, it's a vine. You've seen it. You've absolutely seen it. It climbs up trees and sort of chokes them out and pulls them down.
Well, no shortage of wild turkeys in New Hampshire.
I almost hit some on my bicycle
the other day. But yeah, so we introduced that to help out another species that we had almost gotten rid of.
Yeah, and so many of the invasive species that we have here in New England, we did introduce quite intentionally. Multiflora rose, also planted in order to provide feed for animals that we like to hunt. But then there's also, things like Japanese barberry, which we brought in as an ornamental plant and people had in their gardens, burning bush, that all these that then were determined to be something that we couldn't keep under control because the seeds disseminate too quickly and they grow quite aggressively.
Well, I'd like to ask our other guests about this, too. And Mark Hoddle, too, first, please. Are invasives always bad? I mean, Sam has given us a couple examples of invasives that were introduced, brought in deliberately here in New England. What do you think, Mark?
Yeah, sure. So not all exotic species that are introduced into the United States are bad players. And the honeybee, for example, is not native, but it provides a lot of really useful ecosystem services for us. And for me to classify something as being an invasive species, I think of it as whether or not that organism is a good player in our environment. And I define that by thinking about whether or not it's causing significant ecological or economic damage. And if it is causing ecological or economic damage, then I consider it to be an invasive pest that may or may not require some type of management, depending on the viewpoint that you are taking towards that particular organism.
How hard is it, Mark, to judge whether something is, quote-unquote, a good player?
Right. So that really comes down to how humans decide to define the problem. So as Sam mentioned, and many people are aware of, the emerald ash borer and the immense amount of damage it's doing to the native ash trees and the subsequent industries that rely on ash, the native animals that rely on ash-dominated forests, and even the insects, there are many species which are uniquely adapted to ash. Those hosts and benefits that come from having ash as a dominant part of the forest ecosystem will be lost. And I think you can argue quite strongly that that is a significant environmental and economic problem, and something should be done about it.
Professor Simbolov, how do you judge whether an exotic species, an invasive species, call it what you will, is a good player or not?
Well, for economic impact, it's fairly straightforward. You know, if there's an industry, we can estimate the value of the industry. For ecological impact, it's very difficult because the impacts are direct or indirect. There may be very many species, so it's hard to say. For most biological control projects in the past, it's all been based on economic damage, and most of the targets have been agricultural pests. That's changing, and I hope to see it change more. I think there are lots of ecological problem species, and some of them would be quite tractable to biological control. I should mention, by the way, that Oriental bittersweet actually is exactly such a species, and there's been extensive work on biological control agents at the University of Delaware that's actually it's provided some control in many places, and it augurs well for further advancement and better control everywhere. But the decision is going to come out down to a value judgment, because there are many species that are introduced that some people like and others don't. There may be ecological or economic reasons, and we can't really just drop a balance sheet. I think the critical point is to recognize what these impacts are.
Yeah, environmental and economic. Go ahead, Sam.
I was just going to say really quickly, I think that this point that Dan's just bringing up now is one that, if this narrative is going to shift, if people are going to become aware that biocontrol can be used responsibly, that this will be a huge part of it. The idea that this is not only a tool that's going to benefit big agricultural firms, but in fact it's something that we can use to preserve our native ecosystems. And that'll be part of the story that scientists will have to tell if they want to actually have the public supporting them. And we'll sort of see if that story gets told.
What is the ecological impact, Sam, of losing our ash trees to this emerald ash borer?
Oh, I mean, there are many species that are, there are a couple species that are what are called obligates, which mean that they need ash trees to survive. Without ash trees, the species is gone. So there are birds, for instance, that use ash trees. But then there are some species that may be able to use other trees. They can shift elsewhere, and the impact on them is a little less clear.
But there are some species that really rely on these trees.
Exactly.
Let's take some calls, all of you. Again, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. The back and forth over biocontrol is a topic today in the exchange, fighting invasive plants and insects with other non-native species. What damage have you seen from invasive plants, animals, fungi, whatever, around you here in New Hampshire? What types of biocontrols do you think would work against these? Or are you suspicious of biocontrol? Again, the number, 1-800-892-6477. And our first caller is Chris. Hi, Chris. You're on the exchange. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me. Awesome show. And Sam, amazing show.
Good.
I was curious to know if, after the chestnut tree was wiped out or other tree species being wiped out, if we've ever tried reintroducing them after, the pests have moved on or whatever.
Lots of efforts, Chris, that I'm aware of, Sam, to bring back the chestnut.
Yeah, in fact, the effort to bring back the chestnut is one of, I think, the neatest environmental stories out there. It's one so basically what's being done is there is a Chinese chestnut tree that is resistant to the blight that came over. It is, however, it doesn't have a lot of the characteristics that we liked in our native chestnut trees. It doesn't grow very straight. It didn't produce the same quality of wood. And so this effort has been undertaken to breed in the Chinese resistance into American chestnut trees. And it's sort of a, you know, it started out as kind of a volunteer effort amongst the people who are interested in it. And there's now a chestnut foundation that goes around planting these research orchards all over the place and selecting for the trees that survive most successfully. And they have produced something called the Restoration Chestnut, which is remarkably similar to the original American chestnut and is quite resistant to the blight that happened in the past couple of years. And now they're starting to roll them out up and down the East Coast.
Really?
But what they say is they will continue to have to select for the ones that best survive the blight for hundreds of years in order to actually successfully repropagate the chestnut in its native range. So a lot of the people who you talk to who are involved in that project say that it's a project that will outlive them.
So could that new hardy hybrid chestnut be considered an invasive species, Sam?
That's a great question. I mean, it's part of our ecosystems are in constant flux, and especially with humans moving plants around, that flux has sped up. So, the ecosystem, the forests that we have today have achieved a new kind of balance with the mix of species that they've got in there, and we are once again changing that balance. The question is, is that an invasive species? I don't think anyone would define it that way because, as Professor Hoddle alluded to, we base our definition of what's an invasive species on our values. You know, is it harming something that we hold dear or that we rely on economically?
And as we've all said this hour, and then our values change.
Exactly.
So it's not a once-in-a-lifetime shot, and that's done. Let's take another call. Thank you for that one, Chris. And Pira is joining us from Stratford. Hi, Pira. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Good morning. How are you this morning?
Fine. Go ahead, Pira.
So one of my questions when I think about biocontrol is that it's really kind of it's a risk management situation. So you have some invasive species which are causing economic or ecological problems in the environment, and that has a risk associated with it. And then you have the potential for the introduction of a biocontrol agent, which also has a risk associated with it. So how do you manage these varying risks, and how do you put value judgments on some of these risks? And I realize your guests have already spoken to this a little bit, but I would like to hear more about risk management.
Well, I think it's a great point, Pira. And how about to you first, Professor Cimberloff? Go ahead. How do you weigh out these competing risks that Pira talks about?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And, there's a brand new book that Mark and I are both co-editors of on using biocontrol in conservation. And in one chapter, we'll lay out exactly this problem. I think it has to be done in stages. We first have to estimate the very first point that Pira raised, what actually is the risk of the introduced species. And there are several kinds of risk, obviously. We've talked about economic and ecological. There are sometimes public health risks also, which could be viewed as economic. And then we have to consider the feasibility of each possible control method and the likely effectiveness of each control method, and then we have to consider the risk associated with each control method. And it's probably the last risk that is the most difficult to get at. But this kind of thing has been done before. Actually, in a parallel literature, there are many people that work on eradicating invasive species particularly when they have ecological impacts, both on the mainland and especially on islands. And they have done risk assessments of the various methods to try to eradicate. They've first of all assessed the risk of not doing anything, were just trying to manage at lower densities the invasive species, and then the risks associated with every conceivable method of eradicating the species. And of course, you know, you never have 100% certainty, but they've done quite well at avoiding disasters.
So you think
we could do the same thing for biological control.
Yeah. So you think those have been carefully done, Professor Simbolov?
It's pretty similar to biological control. In the 19th and early 20th centuries, some were not carefully done. In the mid-20th century until the present, they're very carefully done and increasing success rate.
Well,
roughly 85% success rate, actually.
Pierre, I love the question, and I'll throw it to you too, Mark Hoddle. How do we judge these risks, given that there are several?
Right. So this, as Dan pointed out, and Pierre has asked an excellent question, that risk management with biological control agents is something that we take exceptionally seriously. We obviously don't want to be introducing agents into the environment that establish and spread that are going to cause environmental or economic problems. So we don't just bring in natural enemies from overseas and throw them into the forests or people's gardens and see what happens. This is a very long and complicated and expensive process, and I'd like to take a few minutes to walk people through how it's done. I run biological control programs in California, and when we identify invasive pests, say something that's eating our citrus trees, for example, and citrus is worth $3 billion a year to California, and most people have citrus in their gardens, and they don't want their trees to be killed by this bug. We figure out, where did that bug come from? Once we have that figured out, we then go to the home range, and this part of the process is called foreign exploration. And for the citrus example, I spent 2.5 years in Pakistan looking for natural enemies of the Asian citrus psyllid.
Wow, that is the Indiana Jones analogy that Sam drew for us earlier. Go ahead, Mark.
We were in Punjab with elite commando units protecting us as we were moving through the countryside looking for natural enemies. I found some, brought them back to California. We put them into a super secure building, which is called a quarantine facility. The joke is, it's like the Hotel California. Once you get in, you can't get out. And we subjected those natural enemies to almost 2 years of safety testing.
2 years. Meanwhile, the citrus crop is getting munched.
That's right. So there's a lot of pressure from homeowners and industry to move as quickly as possible, but we have to do this safely. So part of what we do is we assess the risk to native species. This is something that's extremely important now. And to do that, we tested native California psyllids to see whether or not the Pakistani parasitoids would eat them. California is a biodiversity hotspot for psyllids, and I certainly don't want to be releasing natural enemies from Pakistan that are going to wipe out, you know, one of California's very rich insect faunas. Our quarantine results suggested that parasites from Pakistan don't recognize California psyllids as food. They would rather starve than feed on them.
Wow. Fussy.
But you give them an Asian citrus psyllid, and they're very happy to eat it and lay their eggs inside it.
So problem solved?
Well, we have managed to get about a 55 to 95% population suppression of this pest with these natural enemies. So it's gone a long way in helping mitigate the problem that's facing California homeowners and California's iconic citrus industry.
Well, Pierre, thank you for the question. Lots of substance to it. And we will talk a little bit more after a short break. We'll, again, dive into this idea of biocontrol, whether it is a good idea, how it works, how to do it safely. We'll also get a couple more examples from around New England. And again, let's hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Send email to exchange@nhpr.org. If you prefer Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, we're at NHPR Exchange. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the back and forth over biocontrol. Is it smart or hubris to introduce non-native plants and animals to kill off harmful invasive species? What do you think? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org, 1-800-892-6477. We're also on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at NHPR Exchange. And all of you, let's go back to our listeners. Polly's calling from New London. Hi, Polly. Go ahead. You're in the air.
Hi. Hi. Thank you. I have two questions. Once I just came across a beautiful Euonymus atropurpureus, and I never seen it before. I had to look it up, and I wondered if it was invasive. It was a bad little tree.
What was the name of it, Polly?
Euonymus atropurpureus.
Okay.
Atropurpureus.
I have to confess, I'm not good enough with my tree identification and Latin names to actually know what that is. So I unfortunately cannot answer that question.
How about Eastern Wahoo? That's a common name.
So, Polly, is your point that there are some lovely trees that are invasive, and you're sorry to know that?
Yes. Well, I just wonder because the Euonymus is supposed to be a bad thing, and I wondered if this one was, and I'd never seen it before. There's this beautiful little pink berry things on it, blossoms on it right now.
Well,
anyway.
Polly,
yeah. It was bad.
Well, I'm glad you called because I actually have a couple emails, also similar questions, people asking about different plants and other animal species, wondering if they're invasive because they kind of like them. Here's one from Lucy in Lovell, Maine. She says, can you talk about the history of the orange ladybugs that come out this time of year in masses? Are they an invasive species? They seem to infest houses like houseflies and live in window sashes. Lucy says they actually bite humans and leave an orange dye on the skin when they land on you. So ladybugs are kind of cute, Sam. Are they invasive?
So I don't know which specific species of ladybug she's referring to. We do have native lady beetles. There are lots of lady beetles who are introduced as a biocontrol agent. In fact, the original success story is out. Another California citrus industry pest, cottony cushion scale, was brought under control by a lady beetle.
Wow, and somebody was jumping in there. Go ahead.
It was me. The lady beetle she's referring to
is Dan,
called multicolored lady beetle. It's from Asia. It's Harmonia axyrides, and it's an interesting case and shows the difficulty actually of doing a risk assessment. This beetle has been introduced more than once. It was introduced quite a while ago in western U.S., and it was not highly invasive. Then in the late 1980s, it was introduced again. To control aphids on fruit trees in Michigan and in one of the Dakotas, North Dakota. And it was introduced from a different part of China. And these two, the introductions from the two different sources ended up in the same areas in the upper Midwest. And this led to a complicated genetic process that produced a much more invasive genotype or set of genotypes. And that is what has spread not only throughout the United States, but it is that genotype that has now invaded South Africa, it invaded Europe, and it's been recorded now also in South America. So, and it is the one that gets in houses by the gazillion. And all of this could not have been predicted in any way because it had been here for decades, different genotype, not invasive. And
well,
when
Lucy,
it was introduced
yeah.
in Michigan, it was tested, and it didn't appear to be invasive. It's evolved to be highly invasive.
Polly, thank you for the phone call, and Lucy for the email. And here's another email. This is Matt in Bedford. He says, I've been told that common earthworms, the kind you find anywhere if you put a shovel in some moist dirt, are an invasive species originally introduced from Europe. Is this true? Matt says, if so, it seems like this introduction has been beneficial to us. Earthworms play a big role in contributing nutrients and organic matter to our soils. Okay, Sam, if earthworms are invasive, I just have to wrap it up right now. I mean, really? Earthworms?
Again, we do have a few native earthworms, but the vast majority are introduced from elsewhere. And when we talk about this again, this gets to the really interesting question of values. When we talk about the impact of earthworms, earthworms are great for pasture and for gardens. However, they're not great for forest ecosystems. And so, you know, exactly when you say they're great, I mean, what are they great for is really the question.
So agriculture, which is what the colonists brought, Native Americans were not doing as much of that traditional European-style agriculture, obviously. So they didn't need those kinds of earthworms.
Yeah, well, they who knows if the, what they did or didn't need. I mean, they were doing agriculture. They had their own form, and they seemed to be doing fine without earthworms.
Here's another email, and I think I'll throw this to Mark Hoddle. From Facebook, Mark writes us, "We spend up to $120 billion controlling invasive plants alone." And he quotes a study, Pimentel et al., 2005. "Do your guests think that this price tag is appropriate, too high or too low?" Mark, good question. And Mark Hoddle, I'll throw it to you.
Yes, that is a great question. And there's a lot of debate over the economic impact that invasive species have. And as we've pointed out, it's fairly straightforward to do this for agricultural systems because we know the value of the crop and we know how much it costs to control those pests. And we also know the costs of quarantines that get thrown up when countries or other parts of the United States don't want to import that produce from infested areas. When it comes to gauging what the ecological value is and putting a dollar value on that, it becomes very difficult. And I think a lot of these estimates that have been put out by Pimentel and others are, you know, best guesses, and there are a lot of assumptions underlying those best guesses. And economists and ecologists and entomologists like me, you know, we often argue about the underlying assumptions that are made with those economic models. However, having said all that, I think most of us would agree that the economic impacts, either to agriculture, homeowners, or the wilderness areas that suffer from invasive species, are very high, and they likely do amount to billions of dollars a year. But exactly how many billions of dollars per year? Well, that's the question that's hard to answer accurately.
Well, and to the point I think that Sam made earlier, I'll throw this to you first, Mark, please. You know, we're always changing the landscape, and European settlers have been here for a long time now. How do we even, you know, make these judgments given that the natural world is always changing and that we're always having an impact on the natural world?
Mm-hmm. So that really comes down to human perspective and what's valued. And as we've also discussed, those values change over time. And when you sometimes take a retrospective view of what's valuable then and what's valuable now, sometimes they may not coincide. So with biological control, for example, one of the things we do consider when we are releasing a natural enemy is what could the future economic impact of that natural enemy be? And one example of this forward thinking is when it comes to weed biological control. So, for example, you might have a weed that's related to, say, some sort of agricultural crop, and that insect may eat that agricultural crop, but that particular crop is not grown in the area where the releases are planned. So people consider, well, what's the likelihood of that crop being grown in this area in the future, and what impact would the weed natural enemy have on that potential new crop? So those types of thinking figure into some of these biological control programs.
All right, let's take another call. And this is Scott and Raymond. Hi, Scott. Go ahead. You're on the exchange. Welcome.
Hi there. Thanks. I had a question for the experts. If there are any examples of invasive species from the Western Hemisphere that have done adverse damage to other continents. I know one example is the bullfrog in Australia, I think. But anyway, I just wanted to put that out there.
That's a really good question, Scott. Thank you. Dan, we focus so much on invasive species coming here from Europe or Asia or Africa. What about North American species becoming naughty invaders elsewhere?
That's a really interesting question. And there's two parts to the answer. The first is that there are many more species from Europe and Asia that invade North America than vice versa. And it's an interesting question why that should be. And the second part of the answer is, yes, there are a good number of North American species that have invaded Europe. One that we know really well is ragweed. Another one recently that's become a huge issue is the red-eared slider, the turtle that's used in the pet trade.
Wow, that's how an American turtle got spread around in Europe?
It's replacing European turtles, and no one knows what to do about it. Another one is a dabbling duck from North America that was introduced to England in captivity, escaped, spread through France, and then into Spain, and it's now hybridizing to extinction a native duck in Europe. So there are a good number of examples.
Wow, Scott.
But it's a minority compared to the invasions from Eurasia into North America.
You know,
I'd like to follow up.
Yeah, go ahead, Mark.
On this, and you know, North America, and if we just think of the United States, exports pests that are native to one part of the United States to another part of the United States.
Such as?
So, for example, we have been dealing with an insect here in California called glassy-winged sharpshooter, which is native to Florida, and it spreads a bacterium that kills grapes. That insect was accidentally introduced via the nursery trade into California in the 1980s, and it's had a massive impact on ornamental plants and the grape industry.
The wine industry in California, wow.
And another example that we've been dealing with recently is a very small beetle from Arizona, which infests native oak trees in Arizona. That was introduced into California in the early 2000s through the unintentional movement of infested oak firewood from campgrounds in the Whetstone Mountains of Arizona. That insect has probably killed approximately 80,000 native oak trees in California's native oak forests in San Diego County. And that was, you know, a short 150-mile drive. So even those short-distance translocations can result in an insect that's native to one part of the U.S. having a big impact in the introduced area somewhere else, say, like California.
Well, it's kind of overwhelming, Sam, to hear all these examples.
Well, I mean, the sheer number of plants and animals and insects that we're moving around on a day-to-day basis is really astonishing. I mean, I unfortunately don't have the numbers with me, but it's on the scale of, you know, tens of new species per year is what I'm remembering.
Well, the Outside In episode on this issue of biocontrol, Sam, is titled Never Bring a Sledgehammer to a Scalpel Fight. What's the sledgehammer, Sam, when it comes to eradicating invasives that, as we're hearing, are mucking up the natural balance of our local landscapes?
So what the title, which is perhaps a skosh too clever, is referring to is that in the early instances of biocontrol, a lot of species that were generalists were the ones that were being brought over. So the example that we
it'll eat everything.
Yeah, exactly. So the example we focus on in the story is this fly, this that was talked about mentioned earlier, called Compsellura concinnata. If anyone, you know, there's one Latin name that I do know, it was brought over to attack gypsy moths. But it was a generalist. I mean, it would lay its eggs in any number of native insects, and the hope was this would just be a general forcing, like it would generally push the population down. But in fact, it preferred laying its eggs in our native, you know, Luna moth and Cecropia moth populations. So these great big juicy caterpillars that are sort of our most remarkable caterpillars were the ones that were most dramatically impacted.
So that was the sledgehammer. What's the scalpel then?
A scalpel is a specialist that will only attack, the species that it's intended to attack, that it comes in a very precise way. And doesn't have impacts on other species. And so the one that eventually brought the gypsy moth under control is a fungus that, when it's not attacking gypsy moth caterpillars, just lays dormant in the soil and can lay dormant for, you know, we don't really know how long, but perhaps in excess of 100 years.
Wow, very cool.
And so whenever gypsy moth populations get high, as long as there's enough water for the fungus to be active, so this is why we had an outbreak this year. It was a drought, and so the fungus was having trouble. When the caterpillars go down to the forest floor, they catch the fungus.
You know, I want to ask both of our scientists one last question, and I'll turn to you first, Dan, please. Give me your favorite example of an undeniable success story with biocontrol, Dan.
Undeniable success story?
Yes.
I was going to talk about something else, a sort of a success that also has downsides. Can I do that?
Sure.
Yeah, so spotted knapweed, one of the worst invasive plants in North America, in Western North America. And it's been pretty well controlled in some places by classical biocontrol insects introduced. And two of them are flies, actually related to Compsellura concinnata. They're in the same family. They're in the genus Urophora. No, they're not in the same family. Different family, but they
that's okay.
Produce galls, and it's knocked back spotted knapweed in certain places, and it was tested very carefully to make sure it wouldn't attack other plants. It was done exactly right. The unintended consequence is that it turns out that it led to an explosion of deer mice because it allowed them to have a food during the winter.
Oh, and deer mice carry...
They eat them, and the deer mice, the population exploded.
And they carry ticks.
Deer mice are a generalist predator. You know, they eat seeds of native plants. They compete with small mammals. They prey on and compete with insects, and they even increase hantavirus transmission. So there's a success, but also one that comes with quite a cost. And it's hard to imagine. I don't think the people doing the risk assessment should have even thought. How could they have thought of that? They did the right work, but
sure.
It just shows how hard
Dan,
it is.
I got to let Mark jump in, too, because we're running out of time. Mark, how about an undeniable disaster in this issue of biocontrol?
Yeah, there are several that have been well documented, and we've talked about cane toads for the control of sugar cane pests. That's a generalist vertebrate pest. We've talked about mongoose, which are also part of the sugar cane industry, another pest species. Rabbits that have been introduced, stoats and weasels that have been introduced to control rabbits in New Zealand, another disaster. But what I'd like to point out with those disasters is that those are generalist vertebrate species that were moved around in the late 1800s and early 1900s, and that type of biological control was conducted in some parts by farmers, largely before the science of biological control had developed.
Not as carefully as it would have been done today. And we have to close it out there. Mark Hoddle, Dan Cimberloff, thank you very much for being with us. And Sam Evans-Brown, thank you too. We're going to close with the Outside In theme music. A reminder that you can catch the show Friday at 3, Saturday at 2, Sunday morning at 10, or of course, anytime at outsideinradio.org. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.